PD Pods present the PD Podscast. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, back to the PD Podscast. And I'm excited to say this is episode 25. We've hit 2 big 25, and we've had an amazing amount of guests with us over the past 2 years. We'll, of course, be back again in 2022 on the first Sunday of each month, and we look forward to seeing you then. Please keep on listening, sharing with your colleagues and friends, and follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and find us on all major podcast platforms, including Spotify, Google, and Apple Podcasts. As we approach the end of our second year, I felt there was no better way than ending than talking about training. And that's training our next generation of pediatric orthopedic surgeons. And who better than Miss Laura Derieu, who is the pediatric orthopedic surgeon from the Leeds General Infirmary and was honored with being Trainer of the Year as nominated by BOTA and presented at BOA in 2021. We're going to have a conversation about her journey into orthopedics and into pediatric orthopedics, what her practice entails, but we're going to focus mainly on why she was nominated as Trainer of the Year, how she views training, and how we can all in ourselves become better trainers or get better experience as trainees. Laura, thank you so much for joining me.
Hi, Pranay. Thanks for having me.
So, Laura, as you probably heard in a few of our previous episodes, I like to go right back to the beginning and learn about my guest and know what was their upbringing, where do they come from, really to showcase the diversity of guests that we have and in our field especially.
So, right, I'm from Sardinia, which is one of the main islands in Italy. I have told the system. I was brought up in a small village. I knew I wanted to be an orthopedic surgeon when I was 7. One of my classmates had an open tibia fracture. He was run over by a car. It was around Christmas time, so the teachers took the class to hospital to visit him. So he had a frame on his leg, the cage thing in my 7-year-old's mind. And for me, when I saw him, it was really shocking. And I thought, oh, he's not going to play with us again. He's not going to be able to do anything anymore. And then by summertime, he was playing in the playground, having fun. His leg, the frame was off, obviously, and his life was back to normal. And I thought, wow, that's cool. That's what I want to do. So when then I knew I wanted to be a doctor, I knew I wanted to be an orthopedic surgeon. But when I went to medical school in year two, we could have some placements, but mostly in chemistry, biochemistry, and all those things. But since I wanted to be an orthopedic surgeon, since I was a child, I just wanted to make sure that was the career path for me. So I asked very early on if I could spend some time in orthopedics. Each placement was 6 weeks, but I was too junior to spend 6 weeks in orthopedics. So after a little bit of pestering, they allowed me to spend 1 week with the orthopods. 1 week was trauma, 1 week was arthroplasty, one day was arthroplasty, 1 day was trauma. And then on the Friday, I spent the entire day in the pediatric orthopedic clinic. And it was fantastic. They had clowns in the waiting area to entertain the kids, and doctors were running around and they were singing. They had masks, they had, you know, they were drawing. And it was controlled chaos. That was the feeling I had. And I loved it. And I said, and I decided it was my career.
That's incredible to know at such an early age. Yeah. And I feel bad for your colleague who hurt themselves at such a young age to help inspire you into this field. Tell me, where did you end up studying medicine, and where did you do your orthopedic training?
So I did my medical school and the equivalent of the foundation years and core training in Sardinia, in Sassari. And then I did my orthopedic training in Rome at the Catholic University. So the orthopedic training is 5 years, so I stayed there for the entire 5 years, and I knew I wanted to do peds. So my boss, my professor, was very supportive, and he said, right, you need to spend some time elsewhere, you need to see what's, you know, on the other side of the border. So we went to the American Academy in San Francisco, and I spent the specialty day in the peds section. And I heard Min Corker speaking, and I was like, wow, who is this guy? You know, these are the people that you read on papers, on books, and then you see them alive and real. And it was so inspiring. So then on the way back to Rome, I say, oh, you know, prof, I heard this guy, he was amazing. You know, he's written so many books. And oh, he said, all right, when we go back, we'll write them an email and let's see if they can have it for a while. So, and that's how it all started. So, and then when we were back to in Rome, I sent an email to Lyle Michele and Min Cocker, to John Dormans and Vince Mosca, which were the top people I met on that day. And they were absolutely amazing. They were very welcoming. They said, yes, there's no problem. You're very welcome. And so then through the Italian Society of Orthopedics, equivalent to BOA, I applied for a traveling fellowship. And they did all the paperwork, they sponsored me to go around, and that's how I ended up going to the States. So I spent 18 months in the States, and I loved it. It was a life-changing experience. But when I went back to Rome, I during my training, I've always wanted to spend some time in Great Ormond Street and in Sheffield. So ultimately, despite the amazing experience I had in the States, I really wanted to go to London and Sheffield. And when I told my boss, he was like, well, you've been away for 18 months. You really need to do this. And I said, yes, I really want to do that. And so then again, I emailed the high school, then James Fernandez, and I spent, I did a fellowship in Great Ormond Street and in Sheffield as well. Fantastic experiences.
How was your experience and between the two, obviously spending time in the US? I guess it would be more of an observership, I guess, when you go there as a foreign graduate.
Correct.
Correct. And then coming and actually being a fellow in the UK. What was your opinion on the sort of differentiation in how they train? Maybe not just fellows, but also their residents, because they have a very strong education support system and it's very strongly linked to universities in the case in America.
So absolutely. So the system is very different, but there are similarities. Training is very intense. So essentially they do in 5 years what here they do in 6, 7, sometimes 8 years, depending on, you know, if they train needs, the time of program and so on. They work something like 18 hours a day, 80 hours a week, something that here would not be acceptable or, you know, conceived in any way. And the bar is very high. Each of them is meant to produce 2, 3, 4, 5 papers every year. But even before, to access training, some of them take time off between the medical school and applying for a training job. And they do academic job within the university just to boost their application. They say that the training is pretty much trainee-led in the States as well, but consultants, well, attendings decide how to better help. They have the amount of resources they have available is just outstanding. They have cadaver labs, they have dry labs they can access weekly. So obviously, even for the attendees, very easy to see the trainee practicing on a cadaver and then replicate the same on a patient. They have a lot of support for research. So the reason why they're so great in the States is because each attending has one or two research assistants. So when I was there, for example, I had, you know, the privilege to be involved in research, and I was used to find the literature myself. Not the case there. You say, I need these many papers, and they find as many as you want, and you find them on your desk the following day. So as a doctor, you really work as a doctor. They have the support they have is amazing. And that applies to the attendings and the trainees alike.
In addition to the time you spent in Sheffield, you did a sort of limb reconstruction fellowship and then obviously Great Ormond Street. There, you also spent some time in Glasgow. How was that?
It was amazing. And Glasgow still has a very special place in my heart. Fantastic group of consultants, very welcoming. And essentially in Glasgow, I did the pediatric orthopedic that it should become your bread and butter. They were amazing. They were very supportive. They offered the challenges that I needed as a fellow. I was the only fellow at the time. So there was a lot for me to do. And I had the opportunity to choose myself where to go depending on the day. I was alone in Glasgow. So I stayed there Monday to Friday, 7:30 till 7:30 in the afternoon. And I learned a lot. I learned a lot, not just regarding pediatric orthopedics, but about how to be a fantastic consultant.
And obviously that all worked out because you were appointed at Leeds in 2015, from I believe. How has been, you've been there for 6 years now. What does your clinical practice entail?
So when I first started in Leeds, it was only four of us. And so I was doing most general peds. So a bit of everything, you know, a bit of neuromuscular, baby hips, baby feet, everything I could, you can imagine. And then the department expanded a lot. So we appointed three more consultants after me. And we finally, well, in the past 18 months, we are slowly specializing. So one of us has Lynn Brecon, there's Barry Foster. Then we have someone who does young adult hip, Colin Holton. And then we have two consultants who do neuromuscular. And then the other two, me and Mohamed Saboni, we do baby hips and baby feet. And I also do, I have an outreach practice in one of the GHs around in Huddersfield every Friday. And so I do essentially a theater list in the morning and an afternoon clinic. And I usually bring along the registrar with me so they can also see the differences between a busy teaching hospital, tertiary referral center, and a nicer, calm, but fulfilling practice in the GH.
Giving them the full roundup of, you know, what true pediatric orthopedics is.
Correct.
Excellent. And I also believe that you have a fellowship now in Leeds. That's something that's been relatively new. Tell me a bit about the fellowship that you offer at your hospital.
So the fellowship program started just before I went there as a consultant. So Brian Scott, who literally created pediatric orthopedics in Leeds and Pete Templeton, late Pete Templeton, Brian started this fellowship program. And obviously, along the years, this changed a lot. So now we have one fellow. It's recognized by VSCoS. The fellow has a very heavy timetable. He spends a lot of time in theater, so he has two all-day sessions per week in theater. He leads the trauma on the day he's doing trauma, and then on the Wednesday morning we are all involved in the DT meeting. It's that part of the week we are all together and we get to sit down and think, discuss the difficult cases, but also plan how to, you know, develop the unit. And then in the afternoon, he has a clinic that he runs alongside our own clinics. He's essentially the boss because we also have trainees, but he allocate, you know, they all agree, but he's the one that allocates them and guides them, involved in teaching, involved in training. In our deanery, we have the mock exam in March and November, and each trainee has to pass at least one mock exam to sit the real exam. So I've run a Viva practice ahead of the mock, which was last week. So the fellow was very helpful and helped to set them up and run them itself. He has a research project assigned when they start, and we, you know, encourage them and give them time to finish the project by the time they leave. And usually he has to produce at least two audits in the time they spend with us.
That's excellent. A very unique opportunity. And I think Adele Fishlock, who's one of your colleagues there, is now the early years representative of BISCOS. And there will be a big drive to providing and highlighting some of the more domestic and national fellowships that we have in the UK. So I'd like to take this opportunity to not only congratulate you on being nominated, but actually being awarded the BOA Trainer of the Year Award. And that's really a prestigious award because it's done by your trainees. And you're obviously based largely in the Yorkshire and Humber Deanery. But obviously 2021, and we had our first face-to-face Congress meeting in Aberdeen just earlier this year following the COVID pandemic. And you gave a keynote speech at the BOTA session. And I was really inspired after hearing that. And it's really what made me approach you to talk in this podcast today, because I was in awe at your vision of training, the levels and steps you go to make sure trainees feel supported, but also help them prepare for what life is like as a consultant. So let's get into it with regards to training. Tell me, what is surgical training to you?
So surgical training to me is the best way to give my contribution to make a better world, and also to give back what I've been given. During my training in Italy, in the States, in this country, I've been given lots of opportunities by amazing trainers. Obviously, I cannot give, I'm grateful to them, but I cannot pay them back. So the only way is to give what they gave to me to the new generation. And when they say, oh, thank you so much for this, I tell them the only way to thank me is to do the same in 5-6 years when you'll be a consultant.
Obviously, training varies because all trainees have to go through the certain subspecialties. And we'll talk about how we can inspire people into going into our subspecialty of pediatrics. But each trainee will have different needs and there's different personalities and there's different social and domestic situations with each one of them. How can we approach trainees at more of an individual level such that they will get the best out of us and we will get the best out of them?
So I think the key is that your training has to be individualized for the specific trainee. So for example, I have 4 months placements because we have lots of trainees and we don't have enough pediatric OPD consultants in my rotation. I meet them 3 to 4 weeks before the placement starts. And the first question I ask them, so I text them or email them, asking to think about what you'd like to gain from the placement. And I give them a few days or a week to think about it. Then we, in the old days, we met face to face, and now we do it virtually. So I ask them, what do you want to get out of this? And they're very good at saying, oh, I'd like to get more cases. I'd like to get to learn about perthes or DDH. And then I ask them, what do you need? Because very often what they want is different from what they really need. And then we have a long list of things that they would like to get or they need, and not always they overlap. And then my role is a trainer to set achievable goals, because only if you set achievable goals, you're going to succeed. So the first goal for me, for any of them, is that they get to learn PEDS so they can pass the FRCS. Okay, they may want to become pediatric orthopedic surgeon or not, but they all need to pass the exam. And then to do this, they need to learn the basics. But in doing this, I ask them, tell me about yourself. Where are you from? Where do you live? What is your family? Do you have a long commute? Do you have young kids? Because obviously, if you have, you know, ahead of you before you come to work, a 2 hours commute, well, you know, and then leads is difficult for parking, for example, when you don't have a parking permit. You're going to start 8 o'clock in the morning and you're going to be really super stressed. I leave that myself and that's going to apply to them. Except I'm a consultant, so I have a parking permit, so I have that luxury. So trying to wear the shoes for, you know, for a day or two. And then we set our priorities. I try to understand what I can do to facilitate their training during those 3-4 months. The other thing we do, other than after we have set the goals, the goals to reach from the clinical practice point of view, we discuss about courses and if I can facilitate getting into courses, I help them out, research if they need some research, audits, whatever they need. So, and we make our own program. And then as you go along, we tick the boxes off. We are very busy in Leeds, like in every other place, I'd say. And I try to reinforce the timetable so it becomes easier to achieve the goals we've set at the beginning. And we check, some people say we have the initial meeting, the interim meeting, the final meeting. They are with me every week, every time they're with me. And I always check with them how we're doing. So we have our meetings that are an ongoing process. It's never one meeting that it's well-defined. It's an ongoing thing, so we always check. And I always make sure that we're on top of things.
They obviously have a degree of work-based assessments they need to do. But in PEDS, you know, we've got a couple of critical CBDs. Yes, you know, they've got some osteotomies they can do. They can do some supracondylar fractures. But how do you assist them in really helping them achieve their sort of work-based assessment needs from a sort of training level?
So I use the WBAs to monitor the progress. So, for example, when we're in clinic, at the end of the clinic, we debrief and the question I ask is, what did you learn today? What have you seen? What was the most interesting thing you've seen? And then we go through the interesting things, and that's how we create the list of WBAs for the day. And then I send them relevant papers, say for the DH or for whatever we've seen. So then they read about the topic and then they send it at the VA. And I always tell them, you have 2 weeks to send it off because otherwise I'm old and I forget. So actually, you know, doing the required WBAs has never been a point because we do this again daily. It's the same thing in theater. So we have a case. So a CBD, for example, is discussion around the pathology, and a PBA or a DOPS could be the procedure they have done. And likewise, the same thing we do in clinic, we do it for theaters. We check exactly what have we learned, what are we gonna do better next time. So the WBA is just, they just happen really.
Theatre is always a very stressful part because there's a lot going on, especially in PEDS. You've got your ward where you've got to make sure they're consented and they're marked and the parents are happy. You've got to make sure your niece is happy. You have to make sure your equipment is ready. You have to do your team brief. You've got all your paperwork to do. And then you have a trainee to train. Tell me, how do you manage your operating days and ensuring that, you know, your trainee is basically getting every opportunity, squeezing every ounce of opportunity in that day without your stress levels going up or having management tell you that you should be doing 5 cases a day, not 4 cases a day? How do you get around that? Because this is a real life issue, especially as we're in COVID recovery at the moment.
It's a hot potato. So my theatre starts 6 to 8 weeks before the actual day. So when I set up my list and I send the surgical schedule to my secretary, I also copy the trainee. So the trainee knows exactly what's coming in 4 or 6 weeks down the line. So they have the time to go to the patient's notes, read the story, what happened, what they've done before, but also read about the procedure. Then a couple of weeks before, that's when usually a couple of weeks before the list is when we know if we still have the list and if there is any problem around beds. So a couple of weeks before, once the list is confirmed, let's say 95%, we go through the case, we discuss the patient, we discuss the surgical technique. And obviously, if they go to a book, I usually give them, you know, the example, which book is best for the specific procedure. And we simulate as much as we can. So, for example, tomorrow I have an elective list. The first case is an anterior liberi syndrome transfer, a TL lengthening in a kid who had clubfoot. I normally do some casting pre-op so that the foot deformity has improved. So my trainee has done the casting. So they already know the patient. The family is familiar with them. They know each other. There's a lot of laughing and bantering in clinic. The consent is done in clinic the week or 2 weeks before the surgery. So in the morning, it's just a matter of discussing the last worries or the last questions. So again, when is the trainee that does the consent with me present? And that's again is an assessment. As a consultant, you have to consent your patient. And we simulate whatever we can. So with hand-on transfer, you cannot simulate the transfer itself, but we've done it before. But we go through the approach to harvest the tendon. We go through the process of how to drill the tunnel and all these things. The second case is a dislocated hip in a 2-year-old. So there is going to be certainly a femoral osteotomy. And normally we simulate the osteotomies on saw bones. I have a couple of saw bones in my office and with a couple of K wires, we usually simulate out your osteotomy. So we try to simulate as much as we can. So on the day, there is, yes, it's always different when you do it on a patient, but whatever can be done before, it's done before. And the team brief is the trainee that does it. So again, it's a matter of showing leadership skills, communication, situational awareness, because then someone comes through the door and says, oh, we don't have an epidural pump today, or we don't have a PCA pump today. So again, managing and finding a solution to real problem. And then checking the kit, what is available, and if something is not available, why, try to find a problem. Obviously, this should, it's always done a couple of weeks before, but in the morning we always have hiccups sometimes. I always step back and I want them to be, if they want to do the case, they've got to make sure the case goes ahead. So they need to check all these details.
You mentioned in your talk about empowering trainees to be part of the solution when it comes down to our current sort of COVID recovery or any sort of waiting list backlog, which we're going to be having for a number of years now. What do you expect from your trainees with regards to being part of the solution?
So there are basic things like being sensible and feel the responsibility. We all had the trainee showing up on the day, oh, you know, I need osteotomy, can I do the osteotomy? Well, no. You need to show me that you know the case, that you know what you're doing. We are not chopping things, we are operating on patient. And as a consultant, the operation is the very last bit of the chain. There is a lot before to get to that point. So empowering a trainee means to give them the opportunities to slowly grow and build up, but follow the process from A to Z. I think that the solution to the problem, for one simple reason, the problem with the waiting list, as you rightly said, is not going to end in 18 months. It will take 5, probably 10 years. And all the trainees we have currently, they will be consultant by then. So if we slowly show them the way and help them to take responsibility more and more, step by step, every day more, then they will own it. And they will be themselves the people leading the way.
I like what you said about a trainee turning up saying, oh, I'm here for the femoral osteotomy, and not really knowing the patient and maybe not even having read up. And that, for me, is always a very big warning sign that, you know, this is someone I've got to keep a very close eye on. How do you make it an expectation of your trainees to be prepared? And how do you address those trainees that turn up for the osteotomy, thinking it's just, as you sort of said, the simple procedure that's only really part of the big picture with regards to this?
So first of all, it's written on my profile on the ACP. So what I do expect of them, and I hope that they've read it or they read before they come to me. And second, it's a little bit about the reputation that you have. So they all know that if you are with me, if you want to work with me, if you want to do a clinic with me, it means that you have to be prepared to do the work. So it's not just about, you know, doing the bit that you like. It's about do it all. It's about answering questions around that patient you've operated on. So for example, today I got an email about a patient, and I always tell the people around me, copy always my trainee, because they're not my patient. They are our patient. We are partners in crime in a way. And I really like, and my ratio there was fantastic, because very practical, immediately reply, oh, don't worry, that's the plan, I'll call them tomorrow. So that shows that actually I show them at the beginning, but then as they learn, they do what I do. So it's lovely. And it's, for me, you know, I had a fantastic wave of pride. And the trainees who just turn up in the morning, well, for the femoral osteotomy, I have to say I didn't have many, but because they know. And also because I actually tell them, if the case is yours, but you need to show me you own it, that you deserve to do this, you own it.
Owning it is the perfect segue to my next question, because something else you make your trainees do, or not make, but help train them do, is helping reply to complaints. And I'll be honest, you know, as a newly appointed consultant, there's nothing worse makes you sick to your stomach than receiving a complaint and not really knowing how to respond to it or deal with it. And you may have a nurse manager or another manager asking you to respond to it, and phone calls from pals, and, you know, it really makes you feel sick to your stomach. So tell me, how do you go about training your juniors with regards to managing that process?
So you're very right. The first complaint I received, I nearly cried. I was distraught. And I remember I went to Brian Scott, my senior colleague, and said, well, what am I going to do with this? What have I done? And the word of wisdom, we read the complaint together, and he said, right, what's the problem for them? What are they feeling? And obviously he took me to the process of how to reply to a complaint in the best way possible. Very often family complain about, you know, things that matter to them. And if you understand what the concern is, it's not so difficult to reply. At the same time, you have to do it in a good form. So just last week, I received a series of questions from a patient who was meant to have some screws removed from an ankle. The metal was buried, so we left them behind. And so mom was with the child, and dad then sent a very long email asking lots of things and expressing his concerns. and saying that he was really happy and all this. And so I told Jason my team, right, Jason, now that's the thing for the next couple of hours. And obviously he felt in a difficult position. That was his patient. He was our patient, overwhelmed, but he replied really well. And then we debriefed. So I asked, how did you feel about it? We checked the form, we wrapped it up nicely. But then I asked him, which is what really matters to me, how he felt about it, what was his feeling, how was he living that experience, because really it was his patient, so you know, hopefully he felt hurt in a way. And then we did obviously a WBA about the complaint, and essentially it's a matter of getting them ready to do this as a consultant. The first time is always the hardest. If you do it once and you do it as a trainee, when you'll be a consultant, it'll be easy to somehow approach the problem and deal with it.
Talking about complaints, you know, that tends to happen when parents aren't happy. And there's more and more of a feeling in the NHS that this is a consultant-delivered service. So how do you manage parent expectations when you have a trainee, let's say, leading consultations or leading this process and journey for your patients?
What I think is really important is the way you introduce your trainee. The way I introduce my trainee is, mom, dad, this is Mr. or Miss or Mrs. so-and-so. He's one of my colleagues. I never say he's a trainee. Yes, he's a trainee, but he's my colleague. Younger, less experienced in PIDs, but still my colleague. So all of a sudden, the perception they have is completely different. The same is in the morning. So we do that. I have a consent clinic. And then in the morning of the day of surgery, we go back and see them. And I always tell them, oh, do you remember Mr. or Miss so-and-so? He's one of my colleagues. And then they've seen them in clinic 2 weeks before. And they're like, oh, yes, how are you? So the perception changes immediately. They know he's a younger colleague, a junior colleague. They know he's a colleague in training, but he's my colleague. All of a sudden, it's different.
No, I completely agree. And I've heard very senior surgeons say that when they were appointed as a very junior colleague, that their mentors or seniors would say exactly this. It's so easy to just to say, this is my colleague. And the confidence that instills is a huge amount, and not only for the parents, but actually also for the trainee as well, because they feel like his peer. Our trainees are not children. They are
correct.
They have lives, they have families, they have mortgages, correct. They have a 2-hour commute. You know, they are adults. And, you know, so I think it's a really important thing for all the listeners to, you know, just understanding how you introduce your trainees to families and patients. It can make a world of difference for everyone. Everyone wins with regards to that. Tell me about what you think is the future of training.
Well, we are facing many challenges now because we have waiting lists with no end in sight. The resources are not, we don't have enough resources, I think. And it's not just about staff, it's about theatres lists, it's about beds, it's about we're going towards the winter crisis, but then spring and summer will come and then we'll have the summer crisis. So, obviously, if we do not operate for whichever reason, there are no cases for our trainees. So in a way, we have to think a little bit outside the box. We are lucky today because we have lots of different opportunities that we did not have years and years ago. Webinars, podcasts, this one is a good example. We have cadaver labs, we have saw bones. So we need to find as many opportunities as possible we can to train them. So the first time I didn't even know, I'm not a very skilled IT person, I have to say. But the first time I came along webinars when I was on maternity leave, I took 6 months. And in those 6 months, I just couldn't bear the idea of not doing orthopedic stuff. So when I was breastfeeding, I had the webinar going so I could keep up with my skills, or I was reading papers. So webinars are a way. Podcast, you can learn a lot through podcasts. And we need to find, you know, to be creative as much as we can to find other ways to train them and give them as many opportunities as we can. Also because our profession is changing. I've been a consultant for 6 years only, but in 6 years, things have changed a lot. And so we need to somehow, keep up to date and follow our own times.
We've spoken a lot about trainees, but how can we support trainers? Because there are a lot of pressures on consultants from management, from patients, from research, from private practice, whatever it may be. Is there anything we can do to help reignite the fire and passion in trainers to provide the best possible training to our colleagues?
So first thing, I don't think that any new consultant should have a trainee for the first 12, 18 months of their life as a consultant, because during your training, you face challenges, but then all of a sudden, you always have someone to go to. The bucket never stops with you. And then you have a consultant and you are their boss. That's very stressful. That's very difficult. And it's nerve-wracking. So I think everybody should have the time to get used to the new role and settle in. And then at that point, when some people feel like taking the challenge, some people don't, but those people who feel like taking the challenge should be supported by the senior colleagues. So in my department, we had two appointments, one just before COVID, and one colleague joined us exactly a year ago. And they are fantastic assets to the department. They are amazing. We're very lucky to have them. But as a group of consultants, we said, right, it's already difficult when you start as a consultant. Now it's 10 times more difficult. And the support is not just around discussing difficult cases or doing difficult cases together in theater, but also supporting them as trainers. So, for example, what we've done now, they've been assigned a trainee this October, but they're sharing the trainee. So there is someone more senior who has been training for a long time, who is helping them to find their own way. And obviously you learn and you see things that other people do, but having the opportunity to go to someone who has been doing that job as a trainer for a long time always helps. So supporting new consultants to become good trainers is exactly the same thing as supporting to become new consultants.
Tell me, how is best to inspire, or when can we inspire people into our field, which is the best field of pediatric orthopedics?
Absolutely. Second, that's a difficult question. I'm not sure. I think just, as I said before, I knew I wanted to be a pedipod when I was in the second year medical school, but then as time went by, seeing the pediatric orthopedic surgeon, the way they were, the way they were with the patient, with the families, that was inspiring. So just showing them how we are without having to do any tricks or, do anything strange or different from the usual, just showing them how we are. You want to be like the people you like. You see someone, you like them, and you want to be like them. So just showing them how amazing is the job we do and how nice it is to be a pediatric orthopedic surgeon. My TPD actually is a bit annoyed with me because since I've had a trainee, three trainees decided I want to do PED. So we said we need to stop PEDs from making more pediports. But, just showing how nice it is, how we work, how lovely it is to have young patients. I think that's the only way.
It's so true. When you speak to someone like you, you're so inspirational, you're positive. You're very flexible and adaptable for your trainees. Enthusiastic, you find time for them, you're available to them, and at all of that, you're running a very busy clinical practice and you have a family. So tell me, how do you manage your work-life balance? And actually, I think hearing about that, even with your trainees or colleagues, as we'll call them, humanizes you and makes them realize that it is possible to wear everything just like you're doing.
Definitely possible. So it's not an easy balance, but I have to say that actually my family and my friends are my strength. I do what I do just because I have them to support me and encourage me every day. My parents, my husband, my son, my sister, my best friends. And my trainees know my family, at least by name, and I know their families at least by name. And I always encourage them to make time for their families and friends, make time for their hobbies. And at the weekend, or you know, on the Monday after the weekend, I always ask them, what have you done? And I tell me what I've done, just to show them that actually you can be a surgeon, you can be a woman, you can be anyone and still have a family. You can be, there is a lot of talking around about being a woman and being a surgeon. Yes, you can be a woman, and yes, you can be a surgeon, and yes, you can have a family. Obviously, sometimes you have to prioritize one thing over the other, but as long as you keep that balance right, and each of us has their own right balance, it can work.
That's absolutely excellent, Lara. And I think our listeners have probably learned a huge amount. I certainly have. And to be fair, I was lucky enough to hear your keynote speech at the BOA, and I've already tried to take small steps towards encouraging my colleague, not trainee, to help setting up clinics, sitting in the consulting chair and really being part of the patient journey. And the hope is that it will inspire them to be better doctors, better surgeons, better managers, better communicators, trainers, and hopefully better consultant colleagues in the future. I've learned a huge amount. Again, congratulations on being awarded Trainer of the Year 2021. It's been excellent to speak to you, and I can't wait to meet you face to face and learn some more tidbits about how to be better in my education role. For all our listeners, I hope you've enjoyed the 25th episode of the PD Podcast, hosted by myself, Pranay Badev. Please continue to support us. I'm so very grateful that we've come up to 2 years and we have some amazing guests lined up for 2022. I wish you all a very happy Christmas and festive season, and we'll see you next year.